basically,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
He said, well, it freeze dry. And I said, well, yeah. Water can evaporate from frozen or liquid, but I said, by the time they harvest it next spring, it may well take on some more moisture, so it's not a recommended way of...
So he really thought he had a guy who was just going to leave it out there all winter?
He thought there were guys that weren't going to get done till December.
Well, I know that might actually be the case.
Huh? Well, surely that's going to be the case, but I don't know if...
It's recording.
If it's hard to tell that, you know, it's going to dry faster after it gets cold and freeze dries than it's going to dry before that. You have to have a difference between the corn moisture and the moisture in the air for it to actually dry. If the difference is in the other direction, it can actually wet up again, but it doesn't do that until it's probably below 20% or so. No matter how we cut it, the drying rate of corn is going to be slow after the middle of October. If we'd get a week of 75 degree temperatures and sunshine and breeze, it could certainly accelerate for a while, but the expectations of getting that just aren't very high right now.
It doesn't look like it's in the works yet.
No, and it's supposed to, the sun's supposed to shine for 2 days, so the one nice day we had this week, Tuesday, farmers did get out, did a fair amount of harvesting in some places, but it's mostly coming in at high moisture, and one of the issues is that it's coming in with high moisture, and when the test weight gets measured at the elevator, typically these are not corrected for moisture, and so test weights tend to be low. I spoke with an elevator operator who said that if the test weight is under 54, which is the threshold for number two corn, that they do apply a small dockage to it. He said 2 to 4 cents for a point, so it's not a huge discount. But one of the questions people have had, because we're so unused to the idea that all of our corn's coming out of the field at 30% plus or minus a few percentage points, is whether those test weights are actually accurate when they're measured on high moisture corn. We know that the test weight of a lot of corn that's at 30% moisture is typically going to be lower than it will be after that corn is dried. It's not always the case. There is some corn that's damaged, for example, that just inherently has a low test weight capability, and sometimes when you dry that down, its test weight may not go up very much. As a general rule of thumb, though, if it's sound kernels, that their only problem is they have high moisture, we expect the test weight to go up as you dry corn about a pound for every 4 points of moisture. The data that support that are really old, apparently, but there are charts around that some people use to apply, and it comes out to be about that. That would mean that at 28%, say down to 15, you lose 13 points of moisture, and you ought to be picking up somewhere around 3 pounds per bushel. I think the only way to make sure that you don't get it discounted if it's 30% moisture and is only running at 52 when you take it to the elevator is probably to dry it yourself. And in most cases, that's going to bring the test weights up. But test weight is a funny animal. A lot of people think it's something that it isn't, or think it isn't something that it is. It's simply the weight of a given volume of corn. It's the bulk density, we call it. That just means that it's not the actual density of a kernel itself. The density of the kernel itself does have something to do with test weight. If they're light in density because they didn't fill very well, then the test weight's usually going to be low. But it also has to do with things like how the kernels fit together. When you dry a kernel from 30% down to 15%, you reduce its size and so increase its density, and that increases the test weight. And kernels that are wet tend not to slide past each other very well. They kind of sit there in heaps. And there's a lot of air space in there, so you reduce that when you dry it down as well. This is why test weights tend to increase as we dry it down, but there doesn't seem to be a standard way to adjust test weight for the moisture content it's at. One of the reasons there's not a standard way is that different hybrids just react differently. If you have some damaged grain, for example, and you dry it down, maybe the drying process increases the foreign material, may not shrink the kernels very much, which in which case they may not increase in their test weight by very much. But the scenario we're in this year with high moisture corn coming in is one that a lot of farmers haven't faced for quite a while. And so it's bringing up all kinds of interesting questions. One farmer I heard quoted saying that he was going to lose a dollar on every bushel he took in because it's high moisture. Well, one of the problems is that we have this animal that gets calculated the minute you pull across the scale, and that's called wet bushels. And wet bushels is a really useless term. A bushel of corn is 56 pounds as far as we're concerned. So the way you calculate a wet bushel is you take the total weight of the grain and you divide it by 56. And that's how many wet bushels there are. Well, I've had people express their yields in terms of wet bushels. So let's say the corn's 25% moisture and they have a 240 bushel yields based on, but they'll say, well, that's wet bushels. Well, the problem with that term is that when you dry corn, it loses water, which means it loses weight. And so you haven't taken in anywhere near that many bushels, as the wet bushels would tend to imply. You've just taken in some of the weight you've taken in as water that's going to go away when the corn gets dried. So I wish that term wet bushels would actually go away, and we could talk about shrink a little more rationally then. But what some elevators do is they will apply the shrink and the drying charge, add them together, and sort of take it off that wet bushels and say, well, instead of this many wet bushels, we're going to pay you for this many dry bushels, and it looks like a huge discount. The shrink factor is one that a lot of people, everybody has heard the term, but a lot of people aren't quite sure what it means, and it always seems like some way that the elevator's taking money away from us. Physical shrink is a definite. Physical shrink simply refers to the fact that weight is lost when you dry corn. One of the facts of life is that corn moisture is expressed on a wet weight basis. That means for every percent of moisture you take away, you've taken away more than 1% of the total weight. Now, you have to think about that a little bit, but that really is the truth. And that's because you've not only taken away that certain number of pounds of water out of that load, but you've taken away some of the basis for the water expressed as a percent of total weight as well. What it comes down to is that the physical shrink, which is simply the loss of weight of water, amounts to about 1.2 times the percentage. The physical shrink amounts to about 1.2 times the number of points of moisture that we lose. So if you take corn from 25% down to 15%, people would tend to think, well, that's 10% loss. No, it isn't. It's about 12% actual weight loss. So your number of bushels would go down 12% from your wet bushels that you thought you had. But the elevators don't typically apply an actual physical shrink factor. Most are applying a shrink factor of 1.3 or 1.4% for each percent of moisture that's lost. And I guess that's where things can get a little bit tricky. the elevators aren't doing this just to be scheming about it. The convention is that they're going to take plenty of shrink so that they're protected in case that drying does some more damage, let's say, or some of the kernels break up, or some of these sorts of things. In any case, taking 1.4 instead of 1.3 instead of 1.2 all means that typically they can offer a little bit higher board price because they essentially have some bushels left over at the end that they didn't pay for to the farmer. So it gets a little touchy. When corn is coming in out of the field at 20% or so, it's no big deal. You know, you're only taking that off of 5% moisture loss. But when it's coming in at 30%, it turns into a lot bigger deal. So this is one thing people should understand, that the shrink and the drying charges are really separate things. Elevators do take off, and one quote I heard, which I think is fairly common this year, they're probably charging up to 6 cents a point for taking out moisture out of the corn. That's, of course, the cost of operating the dryer and the fuel and everything else. Normally, that can be bundled in with the physical shrink so that it just looks like every percent of moisture you're taking out, it's costing you this much weight and this much charge for drying, and it can turn into something in the 10 cents per point. That's where people are saying, well, I lost, you know, a dollar. But if they're calculating that based on wet bushels, that's not a very good way to calculate it. The fact is that a pretty good amount of weight that you hauled into the elevator on your semi was water compared to what it normally would be. And we shouldn't feel, I guess we should never expect to sell water for the price of corn.
Not unless it's bottled.
That's right.
So what else do we need to talk about? You want to talk about damage and diplodia? You want to talk about nitrogen and applications this fall? Because, well, I don't know how much of that's going to actually happen.
Well, I don't want to talk about diplodia. I think Carl has done enough of that.
Right, I did that with him.
We hope that as corn harvest gets later and later, and that some of the worst damage might have already been harvested, and some of the corn might be a little bit sounder. It's going to have to do with what the conditions during different parts of the season were. And I've seen some pretty good quality corn coming out of fields. It's not certainly all a disaster this year.
You know, the one thing I did not take up with Carl, and after I listened back to the interview with him, was, and you just reminded me of this, that at different times of the season, so the diplodia, for instance, he talked about being a June-July sort of issue, or July-August, I don't remember, but sometime during the season, but not the September-October development. And there's probably, and what I didn't take up with him was what happens in the field at this time of the year when it's just cold and wet, and are there other issues that develop beyond the diplodia. I saw gibberella was listed. I think Pioneer sent something out about that and a couple of other places. So that, maybe stock rots, I don't know.
Diplodia gets in at the time of pollination. These things actually sneak in with down the silk, apparently, or at least that's how they gain entry. Under normal conditions, they don't develop that much. The cool temperatures we've had this fall probably have really helped to keep disease development suppressed somewhat. Certainly different diseases react differently to temperature, but almost none of them are happier and thriving at 40 degrees more than they would be at 50 or 60 degrees. So I think that's probably been a little bit positive. At the same time, we have had lots of rainfall, of course. The ears are still tilted up in a lot of fields, and they're funneling this down to the base. And so, but the biggest concern we would have is if it would be warm and wet, and cool and wet is not as bad as warm and wet. Warm and dry is best, and and we'd certainly like to get some of that. So I don't think there's been a serious amount of ongoing development of damage over the last 3 weeks.
So once the air drops down, is there any concern with current hybrids, and I have no idea, about just simple airdrop, that it'll drop off?
Well, airdrop is always somewhat of a concern, but normally if it gets to this point in the season, it's probably not going to drop. We've had some hybrids in the past that suffered some severe airdrop, but that is sporadic. The breeders really try hard to keep a hybrid from having that problem. There's almost nothing the farmer hates more than to be driving through a good field of corn and seeing bunches of ears
yellow
that are
on the ground. On the ground, yeah.
And this is just it's something that we don't see very often. I can remember maybe 10 years ago, a particular hybrid in a particular stress year had some ear drop. But it's not a very common thing now. And the shank strength is, of course, what keeps it from dropping, and we think that's probably pretty good. Some of these that died early, late-planted corn in northern Illinois that got frosted, that might be a little bit of a concern there if the shank wasn't quite developed as much as it could have been. But I don't expect big outbreaks of this. The crop has come to this point, still in most fields standing pretty well, except where the tornado was, and ears still attached pretty well. A lot of really tall corn, though, and some really high ear placement this year, which I think just goes back to the late planting and the temperatures it had after that.
Any concerns on the soybean side? And I'm thinking mostly of those that have been frozen or frosted for at this point, and they're not going to be able to move very fast in terms of number of work days or work hours in a day. But I don't know, does that mean once that plant has come to complete maturity, whether it's because of freeze or just because it did, and we get a freeze on it, is the pod more likely to open up? Do the beans swell that and chatter and those sorts of things?
Well, beans are a lot more open to the atmosphere than corn is, and so they'll swell when it gets damp for a few days, and then they'll shrink back down. It doesn't do wonders for quality. It's good that it's been cool, which probably keeps disease entry down a little bit. We also have had some concerns about the possibility of shattering, but shattering in soybeans usually takes place weeks after they're mature. Some of our fields have been mature for weeks. It also tends to be much more severe when we get some really fast drying conditions, so a breeze and low humidity and sunshine. We just haven't had very much of that. So today I would say the soybean crop's pretty safe. We expect that it's going to take first priority for a lot of people. They're going to be in corn as long as soybeans aren't ready, and when soybeans are ready and the fields are ready to be driven in, or maybe even before they're not quite ready to be driven in, I expect people to hit soybeans pretty hard. There's more concern that soybeans are going to be left in the field or deteriorate. Again, most people don't have a lot of experience with that. We haven't come to the middle of October with 10% of our soybean crop harvested, at least in my memory. So there's going to be some concern about that, but I'm fairly optimistic that soybeans can be taken out. Guys can move really fast with these combines, and they've certainly shown willingness before to cut tracks when they're harvesting soybeans, so I expect that's going to happen again. These wet fields are really a concern as we move here into the second half of October. We like to do tillage, and in some cases we like to do some nitrogen application in the fall. The chances of getting good conditions to do either tillage or nitrogen applications this fall are not very good. Particularly concerned about tillage. People did compaction last spring, and now they're thinking, well, this is our chance to relieve that compaction. We'll go out there and deep rip. We've had, I think, here in Champaign area, four inches of rain in the first half of October. The chances of getting whether that will dry that out to a fit condition to actually get the shatter that we need for good tillage operation is simply really low. And we had some of this last year, of course, where people harvested late and couldn't do any tillage. One of the things that actually concerns us is people go out in the winter or when it's frozen then enough to drive over it and think they'll do a good job of tillage there. You can probably break the surface up and bury some residue when you go out in, on frozen ground to do tillage. You certainly can't get that, call it, compaction-relieving shatter, subsurface shatter that you need to do a really good job of trying to fix some of the problems we know we created last spring. I think that many people are going to have little choice but simply to wait to the spring and to take our chances again. The chances of getting soils dry enough to do a good job of tillage in the spring, deep tillage in the spring, is not very high again. At least it's not high before the time we need to be thinking about planting. And so we may do what we did this year again next year, and that's kind of throw ourselves on the mercy of the weather and hope that our transgressions in the field aren't going to hurt us too badly when we get the new crop planted next year. Our soils do tend to be forgiving. They've proven that to us certainly in the last couple of years, kind of big time. And compaction is something we don't like. We would like to relieve it or prevent it. Preventing it with the heavy equipment that we use today is almost impossible. Limiting it to certain tracks that we drive through the field is a nice idea, but it doesn't match up our equipment particularly well in a lot of cases. I think we end up driving in about half the row metals between planting and harvest with pretty good weight loads. And so it's simply going to be something we're probably going to have to live with at least for another year. We can't really cure compaction with tillage completely anyway, but I think a lot of people hoped after this last spring that we could at least get out there and do something this fall. Now the chances for that don't look very good. Strip till has, of course, increased to a certain extent in Illinois, and fall is the time we like to do that as well. I doubt that strip till is going to work well this fall because the soils are going to be so wet. I've even wondered a little bit if people really feel they need to get some of that residue off in a strip that will warm up in the spring, if some might not think about that. People might even think this fall about going out and just do the residue removing part of that, try to create a little band there at least that might warm up faster in the spring. I don't know if we're in soybean stubble. It's a real question about whether that'll help a lot. I've seen some of the chopping corn heads laying corn residue pretty uniformly now, which might be a little bit of a problem in the spring, but we always have to balance these things against the other things we need to do. Of course, making strips and putting nitrogen down go together for some people, and all indications are that nitrogen application is probably going to be difficult this fall as well, and I think that we just have to be reasonable about it. We don't have the price restriction on nitrogen that we had a year ago, but certainly having good fit field conditions to do it looks like it's going to be as challenging this year as it was last year. Not so much from a temperature standpoint. I think we'll be covered okay there. Our temperatures at 4 inches are probably under 50 already in some areas, which is about 2 weeks early. But this, if it's not fit to do tillage, it usually isn't really very fit to put nitrogen on as well. The best we can hope for is we'd get a period of drying weather that might allow us to go out, say, in soybean stubble and put some nitrogen on. But we learned last year that we can wait till spring for most of that, and I expect that that may be the case again this year, much as we would like to get some of it on in the fall.
One final question. Any conjecture on why corn after corn seems to be lagging so much at this point? And in the not just 20, but 30, 40, 50, 70 bushels to the acre? Is it just that fall applied nitrogen and not as much left over from a soybean crop? What kinds of things are the problems or that you might conjecture are the problems with the corn after corn?
Corn, this certainly hasn't been a very good year for corn after corn in many ways. The nitrogen might be part of it, but, you know, we've had corn after soybeans this year that look like it's run out of nitrogen as well, and a lot of that just goes with our excessive rainfall we've had. It's always a little bit mysterious to us why corn after corn seems to have no yield lag some years and quite a bit in other years. One of the things that we think is often critical is that the corn get off to a pretty good start, and that corn after corn would like warm temperatures and to be planted early. And we've had that several of the recent years, and this year we just didn't. Most of the corn was planted late. The corn after corn generally looked pretty bad compared to corn after soybean, even if it was planted at the same time this year. I think the presence of the residue simply meant that those fields, which were not warm and dry when we planted anyway, were just wetter and colder and stayed that way longer. And we think that a good warm May, such as we got in 2004, if we're remembering, and to some extent in 2007, that helps the crop get off to a good start, has positive benefits the rest of the year, and this year we simply didn't have any of that. I haven't seen much of my data yet for the comparison between corn after corn and corn after soybean, but cool, wet springs with delayed planting would be sort of the worst case for corn after corn, and I think that's what we're going to be seeing this year.
Have you got your plots harvested?
Not very many.
So the data on that one will be late coming out this year, too, on the yield?
On the, like, the variety trials?
Variety trials.
They have one harvested, and I think he might be doing a second one today. He told me that the New Berlin plot averaged 250. And so that's right in the vicinity of what it was last year. Just excellent corn in many places again this year. And I look at yields to be pretty similar to what they were in 08, and that's what the estimates are telling us for the state.
Yeah, for those that are listening to this from our newsletter, and you're listening to the whole thing, New Berlin is in right in the center of state, not very far from Springfield, actually, which is the capital city of Illinois. Anything else?
I think that pretty much does it. We'll get this crop out of the field at some point. You know, it's, I think people are, the only saving grace this year is that the yields are really pretty good on corn and in so much of the state. So it's a lot easier to pay a lot to dry and shrink and take quality discounts when you have 200 bushel than it is when you have 120.
Thanks.
All right.
All right.